Hi, guys. Thank you for your continued support of the Paleo Solution Podcast. I also wanted to take a moment and thank two of our wonderful podcast sponsors. The first is Thrive Market. Thrive is a new online marketplace offering the world's best-selling natural and organic products at wholesale prices. If Costco and Whole Foods Online got together at a rave and got liquored up, their child would look a lot like Thrive Market. So the way that Thrive works, for less than $5 a month, about $59.95 annually, you get a membership that gives you access to more than 2,500 of the highest quality food, supplement, home, personal care, and beauty products. Those are all delivered straight to your door and at 25 to 50% below retail price. Orders above $49 are free, but that's only in the continental United States. RobWolf.com followers get a free 2-month Thrive Market membership, as well as 20% off of your first order. So go to thrivemarket.com/RobWolf, and you can get in on that deal. Our second podcast sponsor is Hylete. Check out Hylete's innovative athletic apparel at Hylete.com. If you love Hylete, and I absolutely do, you can love a whole lot more of them, because if you enter the code ROBWOLF50, ROBBWOLF50, you receive a holy cat's worthy 50% off your purchase. Thank you again, and it's time for the show. Hi, folks. Rob Wolf here, another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Very excited for today's guest. Amy Berger is one of the most prolific commenters on the robwolf.com site. In addition to that, she has a master's degree in human nutrition. She is a nutritional therapy practitioner. She is the author of the Alzheimer's Antidote, and she also has one of the coolest blogs and blog titles, Tuit Nutrition. Amy, how are you doing?
I am great, Rob. If you think you're excited, you got nothing on me.
Well, cool.
I have to say, it's like talking to Bruce Springsteen and Bon Jovi and U2 all rolled into one. That's how big a rock star you are to me, and probably to a lot of your listeners too.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm very honored. If that is the case, then we need to really raise your standards for rock star. But thank you very very much. So you just got back from doing a little bit of work on a farm. What have you been up to with that?
I did. Like we were saying before we started rolling, I quit the government day job a couple of weeks ago, and a local farm in Brandywine, Maryland was short-staffed, and I know the farm managers, and they kind of asked if I could just step in for 2 weeks, and I've gotten my hands dirty. I have helped butcher and process some chickens, and I'll tell you what, if anyone out there does not understand why the good food costs what it does, I encourage you to spend a couple days on a farm and you will never wonder again.
Yeah, absolutely. I just got back from a Polyface Farms gig, and it's people and labor intensive to make the food good quality and to provide the best habitat you can for the animals that are living in that environment. So it's a very different feel, very different scenario than the CAFO model. So
it is. And there's no days off. There's no vacation when you're a farmer. You know, there's something is always breaking. Some animal always needs to be fed. It's just absolutely nonstop.
Yeah. So Amy, tell folks about your background. You have a pretty interesting background. You've been in the military. You pursued quite a lot of work in the understanding of human nutrition. Tell folks more about yourself.
Well, yeah, first, I mean, before I forget, I want to say, because I was in the military, I was just a little short 4-year stint in the Air Force, and I want to thank you personally for the work that you do for the Special Forces community and the whole military, and you and Kirk Parsley, and also, you know, Dominic D'Agostino, all of you guys that are doing what you do for the military. I just thank you personally and on behalf of all the veterans and military folks out there. I was in the military, but that wasn't really kind of the life for me, and I ended up getting my master's in nutrition. And like so many people, I guess the way I came to it was I was kind of chubby all my life, and I was chubby despite doing low-cal, low-fat, lots and lots of exercise. I've run 2 marathons. You know, I wasn't lazy. It wasn't I wasn't sitting on the couch eating bonbons all day and watching television. So something finally forced me to question why I was still chubby. Why was I still inflamed? You know, and I don't even know how I stumbled upon it. I think I got a hold of the Atkins book one day, and I learned about low carb, and a couple of light bulbs went off, and it just made sense to me. And from then on, I kind of just read everything I could get my hands on.
awesome. And so clearly, you know, I've been trying to unravel some of my own health issues, which, you know, 15 years of this and tweaking and fiddling. And I definitely notice that I do better a little bit more on the lower carb side of things. There's been lots of swings in the pendulum from super low carb to, you know, drown yourself in potatoes. Where are you at on that spectrum? Like where's your kind of optimal fueling and you know, best cognition, best physical performance?
Yeah, I would say my other than tending toward extra pounds on my body, thank God I don't really have any major health issues. You know, I don't have anything digestive going on. There's nothing autoimmune that I'm aware of anyway. So for me, it's really managing my weight. And then I would say the best benefit of me when I'm very low carb is my mood. I tend to be far more optimistic and glass half full than I normally am. I'm naturally very pessimistic, and that kind of goes by the wayside when I'm in a nice, good keto state. But my body comp seems to like slightly more carbs, not a ton, but slightly more. I can actually handle some protein shakes post-workout, maybe a little bit of fruit. So it's kind of like you, it's a balancing act, and it's not cool because it is a balancing act, and it's not that you can be 100% one way and your body comp is good, your brain is good, your mood is good. You kind of have to be somewhere in between and constantly modulating all the different levers at the same time.
Yeah, and I have a really sharp young guy, Raf, who we have a lot of Twitter discussions back and forth. We haven't been able to talk more extensively than that.
He's the one that posts lots of pictures of bone marrow.
Yes,
and all kinds
yeah. Great guy. And man, he is all over me. He just calls complete bullshit that my best physical performance isn't also the thing that you know, best cognitive performance. My best cognitive performance is deep ketosis. I can motor along doing jujitsu, but I just don't have that low gear. And so I've been trying to figure out kind of the middle ground between that. I've talked to like Grace Liu and some other folks that were suspecting maybe some gut dysbiosis. And so I'm doing U-biome and all this stuff, trying to figure that out. But it's interesting. It's definitely an onion that never finishes getting peeled. So, I mean, you had some exposure in all this initially from kind of an Atkins-esque low-carb diet. How did paleo and Weston Price and all that stuff get on your radar?
The paleo, I actually think your blog was one of the ones I found first, and it was a long, long time ago. You had kind of, you know, no offense, but this dinky little site, you know what I'm talking about. It was
a long time ago. Yeah.
And, you know, now you have all the bells and whistles, but when I was learning about paleo, it was a shift to more of food quality rather than, because, you know, you can do a low carb diet and eat garbage and you'll lose weight, but and you may also get fairly healthy just from reducing insulin, reducing glucose and all that, but there might be a lot of other issues that don't go away until you get rid of, let's say, soy protein and, you know, low carb bars and shakes, things that you can do on a low carb diet that aren't necessarily the healthiest things.
Right.
And I think I just started getting more interested in the proper animal husbandry aspect of it too. I worked on a very small farm in Nowheresville, Pennsylvania a couple of years ago, and that was my first introduction to how this is really done. You know, chickens out on the grass and pigs eating whatever they can find. And I know, you know, paleo and Weston Price have this sort of battle going on, but overall, you know, we have so much more in common than we disagree about. And I think the Weston Price Foundation really also opened my eyes to a lot of these issues about, you know, alternative health and raising animals and growing produce the right way. And there's so much more to the picture than just the food. You know, when we were talking before about low carb versus slightly higher carb for cognition or body comp, it's when I did 6 months in Iraq, and when I was there, I was in the best shape of my life, and I was eating low carb, but I was absolutely nowhere near ketogenic, and of course, not a grass-fed steak in sight. I mean, everything was probably coming from, you know, the mass companies that I won't name names, but, you know, these companies that produce massive amounts of food. And yet I felt fantastic. I looked fantastic. And I think it's because my routine was different too. I loved my work. I loved the people I worked with. I worked for a shift from noon to midnight, which is sort of in tune with my natural circadian rhythm. And I think that helped. I think the diet was a foundation, but just the fact that all the pieces of my life had come together in a way that worked for me meant that I had a lot more flexibility with my diet, and I could still look and feel, you know, fantastic.
Nice. Amy, there's a lot of debate in, you know, paleo low carb land, whether or not women do more poorly on ketogenic type diets. And there seems to be some leaning towards that. Why do you think you're maybe a little different in that regard? Or what are your thoughts on that? You know, women not doing as well on ketogenic diets?
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, for me personally, I've never done a full keto for the very long term. I would say I'm much more low carb than I am ketogenic. So that's the first thing. And I think I agree with a lot of other people who think it may be a caloric intake issue, that you just aren't hungry enough to eat enough food. And I think another issue that I don't think gets enough play is protein. I think women especially don't eat enough protein. You know, they think even on a ketogenic diet, they're still afraid of red meat. They think a little 3-ounce chicken breast is enough for dinner, and it's not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially if they're doing CrossFit, if they're doing some kind of intense exercise, I think they need more food. And, you know, that doesn't have to be bread. It doesn't have to be potatoes, but you could eat. I just think they're not eating enough protein. I really do.
Interesting, because one of the common problems with ketogenic diets is folks will kind of look at like the paleo template, which is pretty high protein. And so they maybe start migrating too high in protein, but you're kind of thinking that for women in particular, they maybe are just under eating in general and then under eating protein. That's interesting.
I think so. I think there's even within the paleo world, women, they think 1200 to 1300 calories is enough. And I don't know. And I think maybe there's so many great things about fasting, and everybody wants to fast now, but you know, fasting's not for everybody.
Right.
I get a lot of clients that are hypoglycemic, and I don't think that those people are the best candidates for fasting.
Shocker. Yeah.
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 And I find too, a lot of times when people crave sugar, what their body's really asking for is protein.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I know for me, when I get a sugar craving, you know, sometimes I indulge it, but sometimes I say, okay, I'm hungry enough for something else. Let me have a can of tuna. Let me have a can of sardines. And 9 times out of 10, I am not interested in sugar by the time I'm done eating that.
Nice. Nice. Interesting. Yeah. So Amy, what areas have you been particularly interested in, you know, as you've gone through your clinical practice? And I'm kind of steering this towards the Alzheimer's antidote, but I mean, what were you first focused on when you got into your kind of clinical practice, and how has that grown over time? And then how or why did that grow into an interest in Alzheimer's disease?
Yeah, I coming from the background I did, I really just wanted to focus on weight loss, because there's so many people out there struggling so hard the way I did for so many years. And I told myself, if I could save one person from falling into that hole, it would be worth it, and I would consider myself a professional success.
Right.
You know, if I could save one person, especially maybe a younger girl, the self-esteem nightmare that I put myself through, you know, all those years of struggle, and why can't I fit into this dress, and how come everyone else is thinner than me, and all they do is eat, and they never work out? Well, I wanted to try to help educate people about the way the body works, because when you understand the actual physiology and the actual biochemistry, then eating butter is not scary and eating steak is not scary, you know. And it's, if you know that phrase, if I knew then what I know now,
right.
How much mental torture and psychological suffering would I have saved myself? And you know, I don't mean to sound like a religious fanatic or anything, but I would love to spare people that. And I haven't been in practice all that long, but the weight loss is part of it. But I'm you know, I get a lot of women that are just struggling with energy levels. They're struggling with outlook. There's a whole lot of things, and definitely the weight loss is, it's actually the most difficult thing, because I find that people, when they change their diet, they start feeling better, but the weight still doesn't budge. And I think maybe there's actually almost too much focus on weight altogether.
Right. I did a blog post, Paleo Diet, Am I Losing Enough Weight? And it really tried to look at that and actually redirect it and say, you know, are you doing before and after photos? Are you doing measurements? Do you have a performance goal? Are you sleeping enough? And that those things should be really be the driver. And then the weight will really take care of itself in that process. But that's a tough sell for some people. Like, they're really focused on that scale change.
Yeah, and especially I've been getting some postmenopausal women, and it is so difficult for them to lose weight. And it's, you know, they feel like failures when they're sticking with the diet, they're doing everything right, but it just sometimes those cases take a lot more tweaking and just a lot more specific changes rather than just the diet. It's so difficult. But I also, you know, especially having spent some time on a farm, being thin is not all it's cracked up to be. You want to have some meat on your bones. If you're going to do some work, if you're going to be robust well into old age, it's not that you need to be fat. It's not that you need to be overweight with a high body fat percentage, but you need to have some meat on your frame. You know, I think this obsession with just being thin is, we miss the boat on body composition, especially among women.
Right, right. John Berardi did a nice piece recently on the kind of the cost benefit of abs, you know, whether male or female, and really made a pretty strong point that, you know, unless just, you know, that happens to, you know, that magic fairy just visits upon you somewhat miraculously, then it's probably not your best option to be shooting for super lean abs, and particularly all the time.
Right, right. I mean, are we even meant to see our abs year round,
right?
You know, year in and year out? And I just, you know, maybe this is a little woo-woo, a little out there, but sometimes I think how much human creative potential is lost to people just feeling miserable about the size of their jeans.
Right.
You know, I mean, if we could just get over it and instead of sitting around feeling sorry for ourselves and feeling self-conscious, just get up and go write that novel or pick up that guitar or whatever the thing is that you've been putting off until X number of pounds come off. Just go do it now.
Right. Right.
You know, and maybe the weight will come off because guess what? You're going to be happier. You're going to feel good and your hormonal profile might shift.
I completely agree. You know, you start feeding some of the more soul enriching elements of your life, then you tend to sleep better and you have lower stress and all that type of stuff, which all clearly, you know, leads into good body composition, good hormonal profile and all that type of stuff. How did a background looking at weight loss, how did that transition into an interest in Alzheimer's disease?
It all came out of learning about low carb because, you know, Gary Taub's Good Calories, Bad Calories was the first place I ever read about a connection between insulin and Alzheimer's. I think he's got a chapter in that book. I think it's called Cancer, Dementia, and Aging or something like that. It's one of the chapters. And I read it and I was kind of like, wow, that's fascinating. But I have no family history of Alzheimer's, so it wasn't that interesting to me at the time, but I sort of filed it away as something I wanted to look into later. And then it was several years later when I was getting my degree in nutrition and I had to pick a thesis topic. I was trying to think of something that would interest me enough that I could write a thesis on it. You know, what do I find interesting enough? What hasn't been done a million times? What could I really learn about? And I said, you know, I'm going to go back to that Alzheimer's thing and see if I can find enough research that I think I could get a couple of pages on this. And when I started looking at PubMed, I could not believe how much research was out there. And when I found that, and this whole type 3 diabetes thing, diabetes of the brain, I said, I have to write this because how is it that I know what I know about low carb and I've never heard of this before?
Right.
And how is this all over the medical literature and nobody's talking about it?
Well, and you know what's, it's so many layers of this are so interesting to me. Not only are people not talking about it, but there's no effective movement towards prevention or treatment until very, very recently. Your book, David Perlmutter, a few other folks really connecting some dots and saying, hey, I think we can actually do something about this. I remember there was a news piece where some folks were just adding coconut oil to standard meals. in producing some physiologically significant levels of ketones, and the Alzheimer's symptoms were markedly improved. And, you know, these people are doing great with that. It's really interesting. Like, they're, you know, they say that science and medicine, we kind of get into silos, and we definitely do. And I think in general, there's still a lot of, it's interesting. I think we could make an argument that humans should normally be able to eat a decent amount of carbs and not suffer deleterious effects. But for whatever reason, whether it's gut biome or sleep or what have you, we have some inflammation or insulin resistance cooking, such that the normal levels of dietary carbohydrates that people are eating are becoming problematic. And we need to do something to kind of turn that boat around. I know there's some controversy out there about, you know, some people will say that even ancestral level of paleo type carbs can be problematic from neurological health. I have some thoughts on that, but what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I could not agree more with what you've said. I think most people born at least of a healthy mother, which is a whole other topic, but most of us probably enter life with a decent carbohydrate tolerance and decent insulin handling. But over the years, whether it's the way we eat when we're kids, or, you know, over the decades, how much we sleep, the stress, everything plays into it. Eventually, I think some people do reach a point where they are, and I hate to use this phrase, but I'll just use it, broken. Mm-hmm. There are people whose metabolisms are no longer able to handle something they might have been able to handle 30 years earlier.
Right.
And then, of course, some of us are born compromised, whether it's from the mother's diet and our exposure even to stress hormones and things in utero. I mean, all of that predisposes us to issues through childhood and all our lives. So I think, depending on activity levels, depending on sleep, depending on a lot of other things, I don't think, you know, pineapple and potatoes, they're not poison. I mean, come on. I am definitely not a low-carb zealot. I think most people can probably handle those foods. But when you are already experiencing problems, if you are already diabetic, if you are already showing cognitive impairment, if you're already obese, you know, maybe plantains aren't the best thing for you.
Right.
At least not, you know, at least give a trial to cutting that stuff out and see what happens. But, you know, your audience, you have a lot of young, very fit people. And for them, I would definitely not scare anyone off of fruit and tubers and even grains if they tolerate them. You know, I don't think people just don't appreciate how individualized this stuff is. Everybody gets in such a tizzy when there's an article about, you know, ketogenic diet for XY condition, but more carbs for A and B condition. Like, that's okay. There's allowed to be differences. So I think there is a role for carbohydrates in the diet, even on a very low carb or ketogenic diet. I think, you know, raspberries, like, this is not a zero carb approach.
Right.
But certainly someone whose brain is starving to death, they do not need to be eating lots and lots of cereal.
Now, that's something I'd love for you to go into a little bit that is really, I think, very counterintuitive and something that folks don't understand. So with Alzheimer's disease, we call it type 3 diabetes. It's insulin resistance of the brain. We get these beta amyloid plaques that are built up and really a horrible neurodegenerative kind of cascade that occurs in that whole story. But the really interesting thing is a lot of what's going on is that, like you just said, the brain is actually starving for a fuel substrate. How is that possible? Like, these people are swimming in nutrition. They may be overweight. They have high blood glucose levels. How is the brain starving in that scenario?
Yeah, good question. It's kind of funny. We do call it type 3 diabetes, but the thing with Alzheimer's is you can have a normal fasting blood glucose, and you can even have a normal A1C. And the reason those things will stay normal is because insulin is so freaking sky high. So it's, you know, they would generally diagnose type 2 diabetes or even type 1 sometimes with a hyperglycemia. Mm-hmm. But an Alzheimer's patient might not be hyperglycemic because but it's because of the insulin. But with Alzheimer's, it seems to be the hyperinsulinemia that's actually more problematic than the glucose. But regardless, the brain loses the ability to use that glucose as well as it maybe did when this person was younger. So even though there's a ton, it's just like being a type 2 diabetic, even though there's a ton of fuel in the body, in the brain, the cells on a cellular level are not able to access it and use it. So the brain thinks it's starving to death. And what do these neurons do? You know, I don't know if hopefully the listeners kind of know what a neuron looks like. If not, they can use Dr. Google. But, you know, it's like this little cell, but it's got all these projections, these axons and dendrites, these long projections. And that's how the neurons communicate with each other. They send out signals through these projections. And when the cell starts losing the ability to burn energy, the cell doesn't immediately die. What it does is it shrinks these axons and dendrites in order to conserve energy to keep the rest of the body of the cell alive. Well, I tell people it's like a sucking in the cord on a vacuum with a retractable cord.
Right.
The cell will suck that axon back in, and guess what? You've just lost the connection between that neuron and the next one. So these neurons are no longer talking to each other. And the obvious result of that is going to be memory loss, problems with behavior, impulse control, because your brain is literally not, the cells are not talking to each other. So yeah, there's a ton of fuel around. And like everybody knows, you know, on a typical diet, glucose is the main fuel for the brain. And even on a ketogenic diet, the brain still needs some glucose. Of course, it does need glucose. But the problem with this comes when somebody's on a typical American diet with upwards of 50 to 65% of energy coming from carbs. There's all this fuel, but the brain is still starving. The only way for these brain cells to start getting fed is to give them something else, but they can't use something else unless we make a hormonal and metabolic shift in the whole body. And that's only going to come by keeping carbs low enough to flip that switch to start generating ketones.
So have you tinkered much with, so is your approach specifically steered towards more of a dietary, you know, like a nutritional ketogenic approach, or are you still letting in 50 to 100 grams of carbs a day, ideally good sources, but then supplementing with like a coconut oil, MCT and whatnot? Or do you use both of those approaches? Do you have a favor one way or the other?
Well, to be honest, there aren't too many people taking me up on this yet. I wish there were. I think hopefully this podcast will be a way to get this information to the masses. But what I recommend in the book and what I recommend people try is start with under 50 grams if you can, and sort of use coconut oil as liberally as you want to, whether it's coconut oil or full-fat coconut milk. I think I wrote a big sort of rant on my blog, a three-part rant on these exogenous ketones, because I think they can be fantastic as adjuncts to this. If we start using them as medication, like, oh, just go eat your regular old diet. Don't change anything about your diet or lifestyle that may have actually caused this to happen in the first place. No, don't just eat whatever you want. Just do whatever you want, but take these ketones.
Right.
Well, what's going to happen is that underlying problem of the insulin resistance and the hyperinsulinemia just gets worse and worse. So even though somebody might have an improvement in their cognitive function from these outside ketones, over time, they're going to continue to get worse, and they will either need more and more of these ketones, and they will need them more frequently, or it just, I think they serve a role, but I think they have to be only one small part of a strategy, and that diet should be the major foundation of the strategy. It's like, the exogenous ketones are like putting a Hello Kitty Band-Aid on a sucking chest wound. Let's see how much bleeding we stop with that.
Better than nothing, but not really addressing the problem.
But definitely not the most important place to start. But I mean, I totally understand if I were a caregiver, or if I was the spouse or the child of someone who was really debilitated and demented with this condition, yes, I would absolutely try to get my hands on some ketones. But I would not make that my only intervention.
You know, I totally agree, and some of the research and the anecdote around, you know, just take you whatever you're eating and then throw coconut oil and MCT oil on top of it, is that we usually see some immediate improvements, and then 2-3 years down the road, the improvements are all but gone, and then we see normal disease progression, morbidity, ultimately mortality. And I've really been wondering, hey, if we attack the underlying cause here, would we see a different disease progression? And I don't know that we definitively have an answer on that, but I think we've got a pretty good argument. And to your point, like if somebody's dealing with someone who's pretty demented, really labor-intensive day-to-day care, getting in some coconut oil, MCTs, by hook or by crook, we might get that person to a point of maintenance where then we endeavor to get those carbohydrate loads down and get endogenous ketone production ramped up, which is implying that we've also really addressed the insulin resistance story.
Exactly. I mean, there are some studies now where they've done a multi-pronged intervention with it was carbohydrate reduction. I don't think it was in the study the exact degree of restriction, but it was a lower carbohydrate diet plus some MCTs. They were getting vitamin D replete, I think getting zinc replete, omega-3s, stress reduction, more sleep, and a minimum of 12 hours between dinner one evening and breakfast the next morning, so kind of like a mini fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it was it's a Bredesen study. It's actually pretty famous. The guy's name is Dale Bredesen. If anyone wants to Google it, it's Bredesen. And it was a pretty short term study, but he's already, I think, conducting some more long term studies. But they reversed cognitive decline. They even reversed full blown diagnosed Alzheimer's disease. There were some of these people had to quit their jobs, and they are now back at work.
Hmm.
I mean, it was that effective, and that wasn't even, I don't think, a full-on ketogenic diet. So, and I think, you know, I'm sure you've heard of Mary Newport. She's the one with the husband. Yeah, her husband has Alzheimer's, and like you were saying, some people noticed some progress just adding coconut oil to their diet and doing nothing else. And when she first found out about all this, all she did was put coconut oil on his oatmeal, for crying out loud, and she noticed an improvement. So imagine the kind of improvement we could get when we dose a lot of MCT and combine it with all the other interventions that we either know or have good reason to suspect can reverse or improve hyperinsulinemia and insulin resistance. You know, this stuff is all over the medical literature, and it's just not trickling down to the average doctor's office and not even to the neurologist. And I had to write this because I'm like, this is here. This is the people in the lab coats know about this. The people reading the PET scans, the people doing the brain dissections postmortem, they will first think type 3 diabetes, insulin. And how come that's not getting out, you know, to the lay people? It's not really controversial. I think it's controversial as to what is actually the fundamental cause and whether or not this type of intervention will be effective for everybody, but it's not controversial at all that this is a glucose and insulin problem in the brain.
Right. Which then implies, you know, and people will get really wrapped around the axle of, is insulin resistance the carbohydrate hypothesis, the excessive calorie hypothesis? And to me, it really doesn't matter at the end of the day. Once you become insulin resistant, even the folks that are very, very much in the camp of the calories in, calories out hypothesis, which I folks like Stefan Guionet that I think make a very strong case for that, there's still a reality that if we're then broken and our insulin signaling and glucose disposal are compromised, then reduce glycemic load and we're going to have some good benefits there. And we definitely, from a clinical output, perspective, we can hang our hats on that all day long.
Exactly. I mean, it's a very different animal when we're talking about someone who's healthy and someone who has good blood glucose management versus someone who is already, you know, way off the deep end of health.
Right.
In a bad way.
Right.
It just... What's appropriate for a 22-year-old guy who, you know, runs 3 miles a day and lifts and is the specimen of perfect health is totally different from what might be appropriate for someone who's 65 and loses his keys every day and lashes out and is starting to show signs of Alzheimer's. I think it's really not that different from what may be going on with cancer. And I have to thank you personally, because you're the one that introduced me and pretty much the world to Dr. Seyfried's work, because there's so much new research coming out with Alzheimer's that there's the amyloid hypothesis, and now there's actually a mitochondrial hypothesis that seems to fit a lot more of the evidence and a lot more of the data a little better than just saying, oh, it's these plaques. These plaques are causing everything. Well, what's causing the plaques? You know, something is fundamentally going wrong with the cellular metabolism, and that's going to be the mitochondria.
And they've done everything under the sun to try to mitigate these plaques, and it does nothing for disease progression.
Exactly, yeah. Because the plaques are not the cause. In fact, there's one study that I read that said that these amyloid plaques actually inhibit some of the enzymes of glycolysis, which you think that could explain why some of this is happening. It's like, oh my God, if these amyloid plaques are stopping the usage of glucose, well, there you go. But we're looking at it backwards. There's a lot of other researchers that think that the cell is already so damaged from glucose and from being awash in all this sugar that these plaques are generated as a defense mechanism. It's almost like the cell's way of shutting off that glucose spigot is producing these plaques that stop glycolysis. Like, no, stop with the sugar already. And that's their way of shutting that off. Because the Alzheimer's patients don't produce more of these amyloid proteins than healthy people. What happens is they accumulate because the Alzheimer's patients do not clear it away like they're supposed to. And that is a direct result of systemic hyperinsulinemia.
Interesting. And I mean, this would be pretty analogous to some of the theories that obesity itself is a long-term successful adaptation towards dealing with either excessive glycemic load or excessive calories, instead of having this very potentially damaging molecule in the form of glucose be present in excess concentrations. If you lock that up in the form of fat, then it's pretty much inert metabolically compared to glucose, you know, being at elevated levels. So that can be a pretty good adaptation for a while, but ultimately the system is still gonna break under that load.
Right. And I think I completely agree. And it's funny because, you know, in obesity, you look at somebody who's obese and or even just overweight, and they've got all this body fat. They have literally thousands upon thousands of calories worth of fuel stored all over their bodies. So why, but on a cellular level, they're starving. Right, and they're fatigued. They have no energy. Somebody who has that much fuel on their body theoretically should almost never get hungry, because right, they should just be constantly using that fuel. But there's something blocking the use of that fuel. And I tell people, it's as if you've got 10 gallons of gasoline on the backseat of your car in gallon jugs. So the fuel is inside the car, but it's not in the tank where the engine can access it. It's not. You've got to get that fuel into the tank. And the way to do that in the human body anyway is to reduce carbs to the point where some of that other fuel starts getting used. And whether that's to start burning body fat in obese people, or whether it's to start feeding these brain cells that are starving to death, it's the same strategy as to how to make that happen.
Right. I think Peter Attia uses the analogy of a diesel delivery truck that, you know, it's got 20,000 gallons of diesel in the back tank, but the front tanks that the engine runs off of are empty. And the front tanks would be kind of glycogen stores, glucose-mediated metabolism, whereas that back tank is actually fat-mediated, maybe even ketotic-driven metabolism. And, you know, depending, I think, again, something that maybe gets lost in all this is, ideally, we're able to really shift back and forth between these fuel substrates in a pretty dexterous way, that there's not a huge interruption in that process. If we get some carbs, we can run off of that and it doesn't totally crush us. We don't get rebound hypoglycemia. But then if we don't have any food for an 18 or 24 hour period, similarly, we're not completely crushed by that. Like there should be a lot more kind of metabolic headroom to be able to deal with either caloric or carbohydrate excess or calorie or carbohydrate deficit. And we should be able to shift back and forth between that. And if we're in a state where we lack that ability to shift, then we need to do something appropriate to kind of to put that Hello Kitty Band-Aid on the, hopefully more than the Hello Kitty Band-Aid on the chest wound.
Right. No, I agree. I mean, a body that works well, that works the way it should be able to switch between these fuels relatively easily. And I think most people can, at least in the short term. But definitely some people lose the ability to thrive anyway. I mean, all of us can survive, right? We can survive on high carbs. We can survive on low carb. But how do we feel our best? How do we think our best? You know, look our best, yeah, that's important. But that's, in terms of this Alzheimer's stuff, you know, do you want six-pack abs or do you want to, you know, be your old same personality?
Right.
So, yeah, people just lose the ability to make that metabolic switch. And I think that ultimately probably is a mitochondrial function problem because that's where this happens.
And I mean, at some level then, Amy, what's, this is something I grapple with all the time, trying to figure out, you know, what degree of fasting do I need to do? What degree of, you know, maybe some cyclic carbohydrate restriction, targeting carbohydrates post-workout. So I'm really blunting insulin response. You know, I'm trying to figure out strategies for just hedging my bets in that regard. Like, what do you feel like are some ways that folks can hedge their bets on a metabolic basis and keep as much mitochondrial flexibility and density as we can?
Yeah, I think moderating carbohydrate intake is key, and that, you know, that doesn't have to be 20 grams a day, but it probably shouldn't be 300, even for someone who's pretty active. But I think fasting is part of it. It doesn't have to be, you know, every day of a 16-8, you know, 16 hours fasted, 8 hours eating, but I think people are just uncomfortable with discomfort, and mm-hmm. we need to reacquaint ourselves with being hungry. It's okay to be hungry for an hour or two or three or four. You know, the minute you start feeling hungry, you don't have to shove something in the pie hole.
Right.
It's good to relearn the signals that your body sends, and you don't have to wait until you get hangry, but just say, okay, I'm starting to feel a little hungry. I think I'm going to wait, you know, wait until you're hungry enough to eat a full meal instead of like constantly snacking all day, even on low carb snacks. You know, there's no reason to really be grazing all day. I do still think there's a role for post-workout carbohydrates, you know, depending, maybe not for someone who's, you know, 80 and is already with full-blown Alzheimer's, but for younger people, certainly, I think we can consider more our hormonal state when we eat. You know, has it been 6 or 7 hours since I ate last? Did I just go for a walk? Did I just do a workout? What state is my body in right now, and what should I feed it to best either refuel or replenish or pump myself up for what's next? I think too often it's just, well, I'm going to have, you know, meatloaf and potatoes for dinner because that's what I said I was going to have Tuesday night for dinner. Well, okay, but is that appropriate for you or not? What happened during your day? And everybody really does need something different, but I think there's a lot to be said for the carb backloading approach. It's, you know, especially if you're lower carb, then you've spent most of the day pretty low carb. Your glycogen is going to be somewhat depleted. Even if you didn't do a workout, it'll still be relatively low.
Mm-hmm.
That probably later on in the day is the best time to eat carbs. And I also think of it as earning your carbs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that you have to do a workout every time if you want a potato or some beets or some parsnips, but you know, I think it's Diane Sanfilippo in Practical Paleo. I think she said something like, don't carb load for your desk job.
Right.
I mean, hello, like that's just common sense. Like
right.
you don't need to eat a whole lot of carbs to sit and watch a movie.
Right.
So I think you can, you know, am I glycogen depleted? Is there somewhere for all this carbohydrate to go? And then I definitely think physical activity plays a role, but for the older people, especially if we're talking about somebody in their 70s or so that's dealing with Alzheimer's, you know, they're not going to go do CrossFit. So for those people, they really do have to keep things kind of low, I think.
Okay. Okay. When should people start doing some self-analysis, and what type of self-analysis to see if the winds are blowing them towards losing their marbles at some point in a pretty horrific way? Like, when should people be looking at blood work? What should they be looking at? You know, like I suspect I've always been kind of low dopamine. I've got just a smidge of a hand tremor. Have had that since my childhood. Don't know if that means I'm predisposed towards some neurodegenerative stuff or if that's just how I'm wired up. Like what would you look at? It, you know, like if you were to be consulting with me, what would you want me to go check out and see what I have cooking?
Yeah, good question. Like I said a while back, it's not always going to show in the glucose, because mm-hmm. if your insulin is super high, well, then your blood glucose is probably going to be normal, and your A1C may even be normal. So I would like to see a lot more doctors actually testing insulin levels.
Okay.
And doing, you know, like if they're going to, I hate the glucose tolerance test, but if that's something that somebody wants to do, at least try to measure insulin levels along with that. But they, you know, they can measure, I think, C-peptide. They can measure some other, I forget what the name of it is, or some other insulin fraction that they can measure to see kind of your insulin levels. But I would just keep an eye on how things are going in your head. You know, are you one of the quickest things people usually report when they go low carb, especially if it's new to them, if they're a newbie to it, is brain fog disappears. These people, all of a sudden, they're thinking sharply, they're remembering things without writing them down, and they think, oh, this is how I'm supposed to be? This is how it's supposed to feel when my head is clear? Well, yeah, that's how it feels when you're off the glucose roller coaster and your brain is constantly being fed good fuel that it can use. I would just be more aware of whether you're having those quote-unquote senior moments. Mm-hmm. And this doesn't just go for you. It goes for anybody. You know, is it happening more frequently? Are you forgetting things? Are you misplacing things? Is it happening to the point that you're actually starting to worry about it? Or even to the point that you've noticed it because it's happening so often.
Right. Okay. Okay. I've heard Peter Attia really advocate for both a fasted insulin and then also like a multi-point post meal postprandial insulin. So we look at what your insulin looks like in a fasted state, and you want to do this consistently the same way each time. So if you fast for 12 hours, make the meal happen at the same time, and then test at the same time and try to be consistent, and then as much as possible make that meal with maybe a little bit of a carbohydrate challenge in it. You know, do it at 30 minutes, 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, so that you're getting both a sense of your insulin levels while fasted, and then also your response to insulin given a decent carbohydrate load. And that should give you then some pretty good feedback about, you know, well, you're not really handling glucose so well. Like, you really do need to ratchet the carbs down so that the total magnitude of insulin and glycemic load is more manageable.
Yeah, because I think even in the context of an oral glucose tolerance test at a doctor's office, your results could look great, but are they great because your glucose didn't rise that high to begin with, or are they great because your insulin shot up like crazy and it brought it back down nice and
mm-hmm.
quick?
Mm-hmm.
And I just think there's so much more coming out about that. There's a guy named Ivor Cummins, something like that. He's really on top of this. He's got a blog, The Fat Emperor. He's doing a lot of really great research on the role of insulin in all of this, in heart disease, in Alzheimer's, in diabetes, because everyone's really just looking at glucose. And it seems to be more and more, it's not, the glucose is an outcome. It's an effect of what's going on with insulin. So there's a good doctor in Seattle named Ted Naiman, who they just had a video on YouTube. I would if people are interested, they can try to Google that or just follow him on Twitter. He'll post it. It's fascinating because I just think we're going to miss the boat if all we look at is glucose, because it's not, you know, it's type 3 diabetes. It's not type 2 diabetes. It's not your blood glucose might not be 250. It could be 105, you know, which is not really that high compared to the average person out there. But it's,
oh yeah, I know Ted. Yeah.
Yeah, he's great. And so he and Ivor, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. They're all over this stuff. And I think the guy's name is Joseph Kraft. He wrote a book about this way ahead of his time, about the insulin rather than the glucose itself.
Interesting. Yeah, it seems to go in a lot of circles with this stuff, you know. But this is again coming back to some of the early Cordain and Boyd Eaton research when they took pre-agricultural hunter-gatherer type folks, Catawbans, for example, and tested their oral glucose tolerance. They showed really, really good both glucose disposal and a very modest insulin release. So it wasn't requiring a lot of insulin, and they weren't getting an excessive insulin response to a very large carbohydrate bolus. And so it showed that they were pretty darn insulin sensitive and had good insulin signaling and whatnot. And so it just baked into the cake, they were pretty healthy in that regard.
Yeah, and I think there are genetic factors to play into that, that it may be that particular tribe and that particular geographic area, they are evolutionarily conditioned to handle a certain type of diet just fine. Mm-hmm. And that might be really different from, you know, the Plains Indians of the U.S. or someone up in the Arctic. But it's, you know, there's that APOE4 that people call the
right.
Alzheimer's gene, and people think that, oh, I'm genetically programmed to get Alzheimer's. Well, it seems that the APOE4s, they seem to have the worst response on these very high carbohydrate diets. And there's a lot of questions about whether or not they do well with a lot more fat too, because it's what happens to their blood glucose versus their lipids. It's a little bit questionable. We're not mm-hmm. really sure what the deal is there, but I just read a paper the other day that said the E4s produce less insulin degrading enzyme. An insulin degrading enzyme is an enzyme that breaks down insulin, obviously, but it also degrades these amyloid plaques, which is that's one of the reasons why systemic hyperinsulinemia causes these plaques to form and accumulate, because as long as there's appreciable amounts of insulin in the blood, this enzyme is going to go after the insulin, and it's going to leave these plaques to stay and accumulate and solidify and get in the way of the synapses between the neurons. They basically just have all this, they just gunk up the cells, and the E4s produce less insulin degrading enzyme, and that may be because these E4s were genetically conditioned or evolutionarily conditioned to not need as much insulin degrading enzyme. Let's hypothesize maybe they were conditioned on diets that were lower in carbohydrate to begin with. They would have less of a need to degrade insulin, because if their diet was less insulinogenic, then it makes sense that now in 2015, when we're awash in cheap carbohydrate, these people are getting the rawest end of the deal. But they're not. I have to make it clear that there are plenty of people who are homozygous for E4 that don't develop Alzheimer's, and most of the people with Alzheimer's are not APOE4s.
Right.
The number one biggest risk factor for Alzheimer's is systemic hyperinsulinemia. So it's like this E4 thing is not a red herring, but it certainly doesn't cause Alzheimer's. It does make you more susceptible, but it's not a death sentence.
No, and that's so much of the genetic testing makes me crazy, like the BRCA1 breast cancer gene. People look at it as a guarantee of breast cancer, but again, the correlates tend to be insulin related, and nobody ever mentions that there's a huge evolutionary advantage that's had with the BRCA1 genotypes and a host of other genotypes that may have some epigenetic inputs that can shift them to a nefarious state. But women with BRCA1 genotype tend to have lower rates of infection, better childbearing years, more kids, like the, you know, their fecundity is greater. So there's a bunch of kind of evolutionarily baked into the cake benefits that if we get some epigenetic triggers overlaid on those genetics, then they can turn on us. And it's really frustrating to me that even at the highest levels of research and education on these topics, that we're not, when on the one hand, when we're telling, you know, we're exploring some of these genotypes, that we're not hand in hand explaining, okay, there may be some risk factors here, but there's definitely some benefits. Like, part of the reason why you are here is because of the benefits of this stuff. It's not something that's inherently broken. We might just have a diet and lifestyle that's broken.
Right. I mean, that's what epigenetics is all about. You know, is anyone genetically programmed to become sick? No. You know, we're triggering these illnesses based on things that are discordant with what we are conditioned for. And I just, it kills me, because the people that are trying to develop drugs are doing, it's the same thing they're doing with cancer. They're trying to target genetic mutations. They're trying to discover some kind of silver bullet, like, oh, this is the mutation that causes Alzheimer's. And they fail every time. There is nothing, there is literally no pharmaceutical intervention for this condition. So Why don't we stop it at the source instead? You know, let's patch the hole in the dam instead of trying to manage the flood after it happens.
Right. Well, I that's one of the books I've been fiddling with for a while, is a little history on medical history, and antibiotics worked so well that I think it conditioned all of medicine, all of research, to really have an expectation that there was a one disease, one cause, magic bullet solution for everything. And I think that we got really, really successful and saw some great benefit with antibiotics, and it's not going to work for almost anything else that simply, you know, it's just not going to happen. These complex disease states need multivariate interventions: sleep, food, exercise, gut biome. And that's tough to package into a pill or get a patent on.
Yeah, and certainly it is difficult. I mean, I don't want to sugar, you know, no pun intended, I don't want to sugarcoat it, but the book that I wrote it for the layperson, obviously. I mean, I would love if some doctors and some dietitians want to get their hands on it, especially if they work in some type of elder care facility or an Alzheimer's facility. But I wrote this to empower the caregivers, the children and the spouses of people with Alzheimer's or mild cognitive impairment, so that they can understand, here's what's going wrong, here's why we think it's going wrong, and based on that theory, here's how to fix it. Because it's not easy. It is going to require a multifaceted intervention, and it's, you know, some of these families are going bankrupt, because whether it's long-term care or some of them have to stop working in order to take care of their parent or their spouse, and there's nothing to help them. And all I'm saying is, let's try this. You know, let's use Rob Wolf's greasy used car pitch. Like, just try this. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work, but there's nothing else out there. You know, they're not hearing this from their doctors. They're not, all this fantastic information that's coming out of the labs, that's coming out of the PhDs doing the research, they don't have time to write books like this for the average Joe on the street to understand. And I wrote this as kind of the English translation of the research into something anybody's mom or dad or guy next door can understand and implement. And it's not easy. You have to be in control of the person's food supply. You have to make sure they're getting enough sleep. It is, I wouldn't say it's a full-time job, but certainly you can't leave these people to their own devices. This does have to be managed. It has to be, you have to have your ducks in a row if you're going to help somebody with this. So I don't want to make it sound like it's easy, but there's nothing else out there, and I just think this is worth trying, if nothing else.
Awesome. You know, I'll throw this out there, and then I want to talk to you about this actually offline, but a good friend of mine, Tori Zellick, wrote a book called The Caregiver's Day Planner.
Oh.
And she navigated the long, protracted decline of her mother dealing with breast cancer, and was pretty appalled by the lack of resources for the caregiver. And so she put together this book, and it's amazing. Like, it's you take it with you to the doctor, you take it with you to every medical, you know, event, and it provides places to document the food and the medications and all that stuff, so that every single event gets documented. Everything is right where you need it. The doctor knows where to look for it. The pharmacist can update stuff. And so I think that there could be some really powerful synergy there. It's called the caregiver's day planner. And I definitely want to introduce you to her offline. So
yeah, that sounds great. Cause yeah. People need that. I mean, caregiving, if you weren't already sick, you could make yourself sick being a caregiver just because you'll neglect your own health.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's yes. Yes, indeed. Yeah. So Amy, where can folks track you down, and in particular the Alzheimer's antidote, and then the continuing awesome work that you're doing online?
Oh, thank you so much. My book is called The Alzheimer's Antidote, and it's at alzheimersantidote.com. It is an ebook. It's just a PDF that you download. If there's any publishers out there listening, you know, I'm definitely amenable to a real book deal. But my website is Tuit Nutrition. It's TUIT nutrition.com. You can check out my blog there. I have my services and what I do there. That's it on me. I mean, I'm on Twitter at Tuit Nutrition, and
And you're all over the robwolf.com message comment section. You're easily our most prolific and educated commenter on there. So thank you.
Oh, wow, thank you. I not always, but sometimes I try to get on there. When I only comment when I feel like I have something useful to say. I'm not going to just write a comment that says, hey, that's great, I agree. You know, if I have something meaningful to contribute, then I try to do it.
Well, you've had some great stuff, and you've unleashed some big boot ass kickings on there every once in a while when people
need one.
So yeah, thank you. Well, Amy, it's just a huge pleasure finally connecting with you. It's kind of funny, you know, in these virtual worlds, you build, at least in your head, like these relationships with people. It's kind of like, you know, I've, quote, known you for ages through Twitter and Facebook and the blog and all that stuff. And so it's kind of funny. You get a sense of a relationship that really isn't as fleshed out as what it could be. And so it's really a huge treat to talk to you. Really stoked for the work that you're doing. You do a lot of individual consulting too. Talk to folks a little bit about that before we wrap up.
Yeah, I mean, I am in private practice as a nutritionist. I'm trying to grow that. So if anyone out there, I'm currently in the D.C. area. I live in Northern Virginia, but I am potentially relocating to the Pittsburgh area sometime later this fall. I went to Carnegie Mellon. I just love Pittsburgh. But I consult via phone and Skype, too. I've had a bunch of people in the U.K. and in Ireland already. So wherever you live, I'm accessible. And I will tell people I'm not any kind of zealot. I try to make it livable for people. I try to kind of say, here's what you should do, here's what you can get away with. Because, you know, whether it's for Alzheimer's or weight loss or inflammation or diabetes or what have you, whatever strategy you're going to do, you have to be able to live with it. And if I say you can never, ever have X, Y, and Z ever again, and that's a deal breaker, well, then let's figure out a way that you can fit in X, Y, and Z now and then and not derail yourself completely.
Right. Absolutely. I love it. Well, Amy, thank you so much for taking the time coming on the show today. A ton of fun chatting with you, and you're doing fantastic work. We will have links to all of your contact and the Alzheimer's antidote in the show notes, and look forward to meeting you in real life here sometime.
Definitely. I'd love to. Thank you so much for your time, too.
All right, Amy. Take care.
Okay. You too.
Bye-bye.